Hello, in this episode, I'm really excited to say that we got to sit down with Professor Paul Thomas. Professor Paul Thomas is arguably one of the world's leading experts in truffles. He's very much into truffles, truffle science, their biology, their relationship with the world, climate, and everything. And it was a real pleasure to pick his brain and get some real valuable golden nuggets out of him. In this episode, we talk about the threats and opportunities as it relates to truffles, truffle farming, the black truffle, the white truffle, you know, where are truffles diminishing in the world as a result of climate change? Where are they actually potentially going to be in abundance in the years to come as climate change changes slightly? So that's fascinating. We talk about an amazing experiment he did with his kids over lockdown, where they investigated woodlice and the poo from woodlice as they ate truffles and what that meant for truffles and how the dispersion of truffles happened. So amazingly fascinating stories there. We talk about how he has actually created a little truffle orchard alongside of his house, a hedgerow, and what you can do at home to create your own truffle hedgerow using lime and all sorts of other little techniques. I dive and pick his brains on all sorts of things, like with regards to how can I test the soil in a potential truffle location using pH tests, and what not to do, what to do. So that's fascinating as well. We also talk about truffle dog training because he's just got a new puppy as well, which is fantastic. There's literally so much golden nuggets in this episode, and it was a real pleasure to speak with him. And you know, I hope you enjoy this episode. If you like content like this and you want to be updated, you can either subscribe to the podcast, subscribe to the YouTube channel, or just join the email list. Go over to truffleforager.com and you'll get notified, you'll get updates, and you'll get access to some really awesome content. So without further ado, enjoy this episode. I'll see you on the other side. Cheers.
Hi Paul, how are you doing?
Yeah, good, thank you Ben. Good to speak to you.
And great to speak to you. Literally very grateful to you for even just being on the podcast, and tremendously excited to ask you some questions and things like that. I know we connected just before Christmas at the UK Truffle Festival, where you kindly gave up your time and travelled all the way from Scotland in an electric car, no less, to come and be our main speaker. And from all reports, you were fantastic. Unfortunately, I was running around like a headless chicken and didn't get to diagnose too much of it. But I'm so grateful to be able to catch up with you now and pick your brain a little bit. So really welcome and thank you for that.
Yeah, cool. Thanks, Ben. Yeah, the festival was great, actually. It was really well-run event, and I think much needed in the UK. So it was really good fun. I'm really glad we got there, and hopefully we'll be there again next year, eh?
Yeah. Hopefully we're Melissa and I are just sorting out bits and bobs, trying to lock down a venue, but really cool. Excited for next year, which is cool. And hopefully, we can tease you and get you on board as well. Again, it'd be great to have you. Paul, what I wanted to ask you to kick off with, like, I didn't really know this until someone fed it back to me between we're speaking now and the festival, but you've got your own dogs, am I right? And or is it dog or dogs, and you're training them up to hunt truffles yourself, are you? Is that right?
Yeah, just one, actually. Just so one. I've got, I've wanted one for ages, but, traveling so much and all those kind of things. And now the kids are at an age where they kind of help out with a puppy, or theoretically help out with a puppy. so we got one just before Christmas, and she's doing great, but she's been sleeping really well, but she was up a lot of the night last night, so apologies if I'm a little bit hazy and fuzzy today, but between her waking up and kids, it was a long night, but she's great.
Awesome. What sort of dog is she, and how's things going?
Yeah, so she's only, what would she be now? She's like 20 weeks old or 21 weeks old. And she's probably the most masculine breed you can imagine. She's a toy poodle. And she's tiny. You know, she's only like this big, which works for us because there's five of us. We fill a car, so we need a small dog. And poodles, easy to train, highly intelligent breed. And actually, I was visiting a colleague who I work on fungi with in Palencia, in Spain last year, and he had one of these toy poodles, like a really shaggy one, and it was great. It was just like full of energy, jumping around. I was like, wow, how old's your puppy? And he was like, well, 4 years old. And I was like, it got my mind ticking. I was like, oh, we could have one of these. So that's what triggered it, really. So she's a small dog, but she's finding truffles already, and she's working great. So
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, I've heard some good things about poodles, A, being easy to train, and good truffle dogs. Mm. I can't think of how small the toy poodle is, but it reminded me of, I was doing some research the other day, and one of the recent dog winners of a truffle dog competition in America, I think the Oregon one.
Yeah.
That was a Chihuahua.
It was, you know,
how ridiculous is that? So, you know, I don't think size does not matter, I don't think, when it comes to hunting truffles.
Yeah. I think if you're on bigger orchards or you're wild hunting, you probably need a bigger breed, you know, with more stamina. But I think Rue, her name's Rue, you know, I'm going to be taking her to some of our Scottish orchards and you know, and just for checking, initial checks on orchards and things like that. So just when I'm traveling around, so she won't need to put in too much mileage. So she should be great. Yeah, I actually named her after, there's a wild truffle called Tuba Rufum, which smells a bit like smoky bacon to me. And I named her after that. So she's a Rue. Yeah.
That's so good. my fiance's mum's dog's called Rue as well, but it's a boy. Ah, so cool. I'll let them know that it's potentially, you know, retrospectively they can name him after Tuba. What did you say it was? Tuba Rufum.
So Latin for red. It's a small red truffle, and she's a red dog, so it works really well.
Smells like bacon. Tastes like bacon, or.
Actually, I haven't eaten much of it. They're really small, and I'm really keen to do more work with that one. So I want to hunt more of those with Rue. And it's one which isn't, I don't think it's really suitable for commercialization because it's so small. But I'm just really interested in the ecology and how they grow, and if we can get them growing on certain trees, you know, if I could grow it here in the garden, you know, it's just a species I really want to play with. I think it's quite a cool one. But yeah, but very small, smoky-ish flavor. I think they're lovely, really nice truffle.
Amazing. Very excited. And there's so many questions I have for you, but I think it would be fantastic just to get a little bit of your roots and your foundations as you got into the truffle world. I guess maybe the journey started before you were studying at university, and if it did, do share. But I would love to hear the sequence of events that led up to you appearing on Dragon's Den.
Okay,
pitching your idea. So how did that come about?
Yeah, so that was a long long time ago now, way before I was gray. So when I was a kid, I always used to go out and collect wild food. So I was a bit of a strange kid, really, and you know, this is back in the 80s, so it wasn't really a done thing then. So I used to go out and collect pig nuts, these small tubers which grow underground, and wild leaves and berries and even nuts and things. So I used to be into that. And then I got into mushrooms. And in fact, I think my mum trained me on that because she said I wouldn't eat at the table. She used to hide bowls of food around the house and amongst pot plants. So maybe she trained me to forage, I don't know. But so then I got into mushrooms because they were really exciting because they pop up and disappear. You know, so they were really just transient. They'd just be like there and gone the next day. So I got into mushrooms. And then I went to university, and with mushrooms in my mushroom books, I read about truffles and I could never find them. So I started to look into ways of growing them, and I'd never tried them at this stage. And then when I started looking at the science, it just blew my mind. There was a lady called Susan Simard over in the States, and she subsequently published a lot of work on mycorrhizae. And one of her earlier papers, she looked at carbon fluxes between mature and young trees and transfer of resources between these trees through the mycorrhizae, so the fungi connecting them. And it just blew me away. So I ended up, I was doing a PhD on signaling systems in plants, and I just got completely sidetracked. Looked at mycorrhizae, fungi, got really into truffles, and a nice way to fund it was if I could set up a truffle farm, my own truffle farm, work for half of the year on that, and the other half of the year just do research. And that was the original idea, and that's what I naively went down to the Dragon's Den with, because the university gave me some money to do this. And and the BBC had approached them, and this is before they approached them saying they had this program with investors and did they have any students with business ideas. So they put me forward for it, and I didn't really know if I wanted investments. So I went the night, but turned out that wasn't the case. So so that's how I ended up in the Dragon's Den. Yeah, a lot long, long time ago.
Okay, cool. Back with you. Hopefully the Wi-Fi is going to stick up. All good.
Yeah.
So, Dragon's Den. And So I also saw one of your publications was, you know, very, you know, kudos, congratulations to you for like being the first cultivator of the Perigord black, you know, truffle in the UK, I believe. How was that? Yeah. Talk to us about that. Like, you know, was it, and what was the journey? I mean, there's a long time between, I guess, Dragon's Den and getting perhaps the funding which led to that realization. But you know, here's a big question for you. What happened in those 12 years and how did you do it?
So it happened very slowly, actually. So after the Dragon's Den, so on the den, I was offered funding by a couple of the dragons who had a bit of set to with each other, and I subsequently went with one and agreed to go with him. But then after filming and in subsequent discussions, I just decided it probably wasn't the right route. You know, he wanted to do bigger commercial stuff, and I'm sure financially it would have been great, but I wanted to focus on the science and getting this working and getting cultivation working and focus on that rather than doing clothing lines and foods and other kinds of things at that stage. So so I still talk to Simon. So it's Simon Woodruff, super nice guy. And but we decided it wasn't the right route. So then, rather than doing one orchard, then I started to realize if we partnered with people, so if we joined forces with other growers, we could essentially create a massive data set. So everyone who's grown under one umbrella, we use the same methods, the same technology, the same monitoring. And doing that from a scientific point of view, we can gather a huge amount of data and start to learn, you know, and start to see a bit further and answer some of these questions in truffle cultivation. So that's what I started to do. And it took a long time. It took a long time to scale up the technology to produce the trees. That took a good few years. And then we started to put our first orchards in the ground. So, it was a long way. And we started to do the Perigord truffle as well. So we mainly focus on our native species here, which is the Burgundy truffle, which is the one we celebrate, of course, at the UK Truffle Festival. But we also did some of this Mediterranean ones, which is the Perigord truffle, Tuber melanosporum, mainly to just see how it survives. So we planted them not thinking it was going to fruit, just to see how the mycorrhizae, so the roots of the fungus, if you like, how they survived in the ground. And that was great. And we got some nice data. And then one was planted on a site where the chap was harvesting summer truffles. So he had summer truffles as well. And his dog kept going over to the winter truffle side and he was pulling her back. Bella, the dog was called. And eventually let her go over and went over and dug up this really ripe, delicious, amazingly scented Perigord truffle. And it was like, wow. And he subsequently harvested more. So it was a bit of a light bulb moment. And I published that with a colleague down in Cambridge back in 2017. And we worked out the reason it's working now in the UK and why we don't have it naturally is that since the Industrial Revolution, the temperatures have just increased just enough and the winters have got mild just enough to allow this species to fruit and grow here. So I think it's something we can expand in the UK, but I'm still quite bearish on it. So I normally advise people not to do it on any big scale, maybe just 100 trees, do it on a small experimental scale. But I think it's something we need to work on more and look at where suitable. I should also mention, actually, is after we published the paper, there was a chap down further south. So this one was quite north. This was in Wales. Further south, who also said that they produced the Perigord truffle a couple of years before that. And I've which is super cool. So I've got no details on it. They wouldn't give me any details on it because I'd like to see soil, look at the climate where it is. But apparently they also did it. So I should mention that as well. So
but they're keeping it a bit hush hush, do you think?
Yeah. I'd love to know more details, but apparently they did as well. So and the thing that goes through my mind is as well, without verifying it, you know, it could be one of the related winter truffle species. I'm not sure if it's the Perigord, but as we produce that one in Wales, it's totally likely that further south that could fruit as well. So it probably is a correct statement, but so quite exciting. So I think probably two places in the UK. Yeah.
Awesome. And I know touching on that, and I know you spoke about this a bit at the festival, threats and opportunities with truffles. Obviously you've just touched on the UK might be poised to be going in a really good direction for lending itself to experience truffle growth, probably naturally, and also people wanting to cultivate it, I would suspect. But also, can you talk a bit more about that? But then also the opposite side, you know, if the climate is changing, you know, what's that having, what effect is that having on truffles globally? And is it getting worse in certain places than others?
Yeah, definitely. So this is a big topic for me. I started working on this, started working on it maybe 4 or 5 years ago now, started looking at climate in more detail. And we had some really good access to some really good data sets in France, Spain, and Italy. So over 40 years worth of gross truffle production data, and we could correlate that with weather patterns. So it's a really nice, strong data set for analysis. And from that, we started to look at the correlations between weather patterns, so between summer temperatures, summer precipitation, and you start to get some nice information there so that, you know, different conditions produce different yields, and you start to see statistically some quite good information. And then I got quite interested in, well, how's it going to play out? You know, how will it look in the future? So we took that data and overlaid it onto climate change models. So these are really big, recognized, widely recognized and widely used in the research community, climate change models going forward, and predicted what would happen. And the range we use is 2071 to 2100, because in these models, that's the time period we have the outputs for with relatively decent certainty. And through correlating all this data, we worked out that we're almost certainly looking at a collapse in the Mediterranean basin of this Perigord truffle by 2071, which is within a generation. And it was a big shock, really. So the model shows an almost complete collapse under one of the higher climate change scenarios. But within that, you know, that's a gross level thing. So there will be small sites with microclimates where there will still be small amounts of production. But I think the big take home message is that we're predicting and expecting a big collapse in production. And this is because the Mediterranean is warming faster than a lot of areas globally. It's warming much faster than the global average. Spain especially, we're going to see very high temperatures and drier conditions. And in fact, we're already seeing it. So in the truffle data, one of my colleagues, Ulf Bunchen at Cambridge, he's published correlations where we're already seeing these downward trends. You know, it's already starting. So that's, you know, why I took an electric vehicle down to the truffle festival. And I changed my life massively after working on that, because it was a bit of a shock. And then in the UK, you know, there's risks and opportunities there. So one opportunity is we're growing this Perigord truffle now in the UK, which is fantastic. But one of the downsides is in these drier conditions, I think our native species struggles as well. And at the time we did that project, we didn't have enough data on our native species here in the UK to look at what would happen here. And we still don't really. We still don't have a very big data set. But we saw last year, you know, and you know from talking to truffle hunters, last year was very, very hard because of the droughts and the heat, and we saw a big drop in production. And there was a paper published just a few years ago showing that a 1 degree temperature shift in average over the summer months for where these summer truffles grow can cause a 22% decline in production. 3 degrees can make it drop completely. So in the UK, you know, the east, some of the centre areas and the south fared quite badly. But our sites in Scotland, we had two sites in Southern Ireland, in the Republic of Ireland, which began production last year. Wales, the north and west of the country fared really, really well. We got really good production. And I think that's because, you know, it's got that damper, cooler climate. So we're seeing this sort of mixed story in the UK, where the east and the south is probably, we're going to have more suffering there in terms of truffle production, but the north and the west is going to fare a bit better. And the thing to mention as well, of course, the north and west doesn't traditionally have much truffle because the soils aren't really suitable. So the ones that are coming out are coming from cultivation where we've added lime and amended the soils. But it's so there's these risks and opportunities, you know, and but the truffle is just a canary in the coal mine, really. You know, I think we're going to face, I hate to say it really, because I'm always accused of being doom and gloom, but I think we're going to face much bigger problems than our truffle supply. So a lot of my research now, actually, I do a lot on truffles, but I'm also doing a chunk on climate change mitigation methods and how we can apply this technology to look at solutions and ways to draw down carbon in food production and such. So it's a bit of a diversion, really, from truffles, but it's,
fascinating. With the The potential drop-off in the Périgord black truffles, which you just mentioned in the Mediterranean basis, do you also believe that something similar is inevitably going to be happening for the Tuber magnatum, the white truffle that's growing in the Med? Or, I mean, yeah. I guess the data is probably not there.
Yeah, so there is some loose data with that, again, correlating it to dry and warmer conditions. So that definitely happens. We're still trying to collate more data on that. So that the magnatum truffle grows in, obviously, northern Italy, also in Serbia, in Croatia. It's even in Switzerland. There's a river in Switzerland where there's a small naturally producing area there. So for sure that will suffer. The other thing I should mention is we published a paper last year looking at truffle production zones all over the world. So we looked at South Africa, we looked at California, we looked at Australia. And some of these newer territories are going to be a little bit more resilient to climate change, it looks like, than the Mediterranean. So some of that production will move elsewhere, but it's going to have to be big. You know, France alone plants about 400,000 truffle inoculated trees every single year. And it's been keeping their production just static, and it's slowly coming down now, in fact. So, you know, it's got to be done on a big scale elsewhere to counteract that kind of drop. So, yeah.
So, sorry, I may have misunderstood what you said there. They're planting 400,000 truffle trees every year, but the production is staying the same.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just maintaining things. And France started 50 years ago, so they started in the 70s. They were the first, really, to successfully cultivate truffles. In fact, there was a chap going back even 100 or so years before then who produced truffles actually in France by lifting baby trees from truffle producing regions and seeds and transplanting them to other fields. And he thought it was the tree that was important. But by doing that, he inadvertently transferred some of the fungus that was growing on that root system and some of the spore and transferred it to new sites. And some of those sites produced. So he's a chap called Joseph Talon, and he was really the first one to produce truffles. But then it wasn't until the 70s that they got these more methodical techniques. And France's truffle production dropped from over 1,000 tons a year to what is now, in a very good year, would be a maximum of 80 tons. And it just plummeted due to habitat loss, changing socioeconomic conditions, which mean woodland was managed differently. And then you see this graph plummeting, and then cultivation steps in, and then it just kind of starts to tick over. Yeah, 95% of all the truffles are cultivated now in France, which is incredible.
And back in the UK, I've got no idea, but I'm sure if there's anybody who's got half an idea, like how many sites or truffle farmers would you approximate that we have in the UK at the minute?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a good question. There are, I really don't know. I know truffle cultivators, I would say there's close to 100 probably, with orchards of different sizes. The majority of these aren't hunting though. So we had five new sites begin production that I know of last year. The majority of them with our trees. So the ones where clients had contacted us. There was one lady contacted us saying, you know, how do I find truffles? I think my trees are mature. And we were like, you need to train a dog, et cetera, et cetera. We're giving her advice. And she went out into the garden, just had to scratch around and came back in with some pictures and found some truffles, which is really lucky. You know, it's so, as you know, they're so hard to find, even if you've got a narrow area. So she found some. There was another guy who was picking up hazelnuts around his trees and he found truffles. And one of the sites in Ireland, that was a visiting truffle dog who was only there for an hour, and they pulled up just over a kilo. So there's these sites, and none of them have got a truffle dog yet. So there's a lot which aren't being harvested, which is a bottleneck in the UK and something that I hope will change. And something, you know, your event, I hope, is gonna stimulate interest in as well. So, yeah.
Yeah,
awesome. But I think there's a lot.
Yeah. The other thing I was going to ask you is... Because you've covered quite a lot in terms of your scientific exploits into truffles and beyond truffles as well. But I wanted to ask you, out of everything that you've done perhaps in the past or something maybe you're working on now, what's currently like really captivating you at the moment? What's exciting you at the moment?
It's all science. It's all research. It's all research. That's the most exciting thing for me. We discovered a cool thing last year with insects and truffles, and we're growing that. This climate change mitigation stuff, we're applying for a bigger grant at the moment to try and take that forward. We've got a PhD student working on it. Oh, and we're setting up a lab to focus on that in Scotland, Which will also have a very small truffle museum attached to it, like one of these quaint agricultural museums, you know, that you see dotted around. We're going to have one there with information boards and so people can visit freely with a demonstration orchard. So I'm really excited about that. You know, school kids can come up at small educational facility where we can, educate people. So, those are my main things. It's all research and education, really, are the super exciting stuff for me. Yeah.
What's the... can you talk me more about the insects and truffle one that you just dropped in there? What's going on there?
Yeah, so this all started back in the pandemic, actually. So in the pandemic, I had my kids home from school, and they weren't doing any online schooling at this point. So I thought, you know, their education's really going to suffer here, so let's do some stuff. I had a DNA testing equipment in my cellar. It's PCR, so it's just simple DNA analysis. I say simple, but it is relatively complex. And so I had my kids, my 4 9-year-old, 6-year-old, and I guess she was 10 or 11 at the time, daughter. I had them doing serial dilutions and doing DNA analysis in the cellar, you know, to try and keep their education going. And then I thought, well, let's do some experiments as well. And I looked back at those notes, actually, and thought, what the hell was I doing? You know, that was too much for the kids. But we looked at doing some experiments as well. I thought, let's do some hands-on stuff, getting them really interested. And I'd often found woodlice with truffles, these tiny little insects. And I was talking to my son about it, and it's like, well, we don't know if they eat them. We don't know if they're sheltering in them. We don't know what's going on. So let's find out. So my daughters went out and collected some woodlice from outside. They made them nice little homes, you know, and we like all good kitchens in Scotland, we had some truffle in the fridge. So we fed them some truffle, put them in these little homes. And then we collected their poop, and we collected their poop, and they lay these little square fecal pellets. We put them under the microscope, and lo and behold, they were just packed full of spore. So I thought, let's do this in a more regimented way. So we made these homes that my daughters made. We've then turned them into proper little microcosms, so proper replicated groups. And we did this in a really controlled way. And my son, bless him, you know, every hour he was collecting the woodlice poop, putting it under the microscope. I was sat there with him. He was counting the spores in them. We were taking pictures, looking at them. And we discovered some super cool stuff. So we discovered when the woodlice eat the truffle, out the other side, and they preferentially eat truffle, they love it. Out the other side, it's just, their poop is just spores. It's just a mass of spores. So they're not digesting the spores, they're passing them through. And when we took the truffle away, we then checked their poop as well to see how long the truffles are still coming out. And it went on for 24 hours. And then I was like, well, we're going to have to move from hourly because we need some sleep. So we'll do it daily. And we got to like day 10, it was still going. We got to day, I think it was 18 or 19, and still 25% of the fecal pellets, we could still find one or two truffle spores undamaged in the fecal pellet. So when an insect has consumed it, they can go off walking for 18 or 19 days and still be dropping these pellets. And with truffle spores in. And this is important because the spore provides the truffles need male and two opposite male and female strains, if you want to call them that, to come together to produce the actual fruiting body. So it's like pollination in plants. Mm. So you need some mechanism to get the spores in the ground. And we're kind of unsure as to what that is, but it looks like insects might be quite a good vehicle for that. And there's some good genetic data that backs that up as well. So that was really exciting. So we published that, and my son's in the paper, and my daughters are in the acknowledgements. So that was really cool. And then we've taken it further. So I was in the Czech Republic with a team of academics a few months ago, just before the festival, in fact, and we went out hunting in different regions, finding new sites, and I collected lots of insects where we were finding truffles, and again, checked the digestive tract and millipedes and stuff like that, you know, guts are just full of spores. So so yeah, I'm really interested in food webs now and how that feeds truffle production and things like that, and it has a relation to climate as well. But yeah, so a long story, but truffles and insects, yeah, super super keen on it at the moment. Yeah,
that is literally fantastic. You started to touch on it there, and I was curious about this, you know, with regards to the birth of a new truffle from spores and sex, and and your talk was titled "Sex Truffle Sex and DNA" or something along those lines.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us about that? Like, basically, can you educate us the the novice person who knows nothing about how truffles come about, like what is actually needed in the beginnings of that?
Yeah, definitely. So truffles, the basic biology is they're what's called a mycorrhizal fungi. So they grow on the root system of a tree. They cover the root system of the tree or the root tips of a tree, and they form a structure with a tree called a mycorrhiza. And that just facilitates communication and transfer between the fungus and the tree. The fungus can't survive, by the way, without the tree. So the tree will send its sugars. The fungus sends lots of fine threads out into the soil. They gather nutrients, transfer them to the tree. So they have this mutualistic partnership where they're sharing resources. So that's how the fungus grows, and that's where the bulk of the organism is. The bit we see, the truffles, are just the fruiting body. It's like the apple of the apple tree. It's just the bit with the reproductive material in. And truffles, to form these truffles, it used to be thought that the mycelium could just bud them off like yeast. They could produce them clonally, but we now know that's not true. We now know there's two, what we call mating types, need to come together to form the truffle. And these are catchily named Idiomorph 1-1 and Idiomorph 1-2, so we don't call them male and female. There are two variations. And actually, some fungi can have tens of mating types, you know, a whole wide range of mating. In fact, I'm quite distracted by the behind you, Ben. There's a mushroom on the shelf. What is that? What species is that? Do you know? Or,
I don't even know, to be honest. I put it there just for a bit of decoration, because quite a lot of mess in our upstairs study here at the moment. But yeah, well done for catching that.
it's
too distracting. I can move it.
No, so I was going to say that some fungi like this, above ground fungi, they can have many different types of mating types, really complex life cycles. So truffles just have these two. And what needs to happen is the fungus, which is growing on the root system of the tree, it, say if that's Idiomorph 1-1, it needs the other type, 1-2, to come into contact with it to form the truffle. And we know this from very good genetic evidence, so we know that needs to happen. But how that happens is currently unknown. So we don't know if that's coming from other mycelium colonies in the ground, so other fungi colonies coming together underground, or if it's spores coming in and forming that parental partner, so allowing that, if you like, pollination. That's what we call it in plants. It's pollination, but below ground with fungi, it's different terms, but it's this, it needs this coming together of the two strains. Yeah, go on.
Or just to clarify for my own head, so there's two different spore types that need to come together to then build, create a new, are we talking a new truffle fruiting body, or are we talking a new beginnings of a mycorrhizae organism?
Yeah, good point. So the truffle fruiting body, just the individual truffle, and this happens for individual truffles, so it's happening for each individual truffle or probably truffle cluster. So this is, you know, this is going on all over in the ground where you've got truffles in the ground. The reason why we think it might be spores is through genetic evidence, when you look at the truffle, it looks like the parental side, so the bit where the material's coming in by spores or another mycelium, that's, it looks like it changes quite frequently. So it's never the same contributor, you know, so you can see that. You can see that in using genetic techniques. So we know it changes quite frequently, which suggests it's something being brought in and not something which is existing solidly there in the soil, which suggests spores, you know. So that's the evidence we've got, which points towards it being spores or mycelium being dropped. It's not 100%, but that's possibly what happens. I don't know if I've made that too complex, but
no, it's fine. I'm going to ask some more clarifying questions. And so, in order for us to produce a new truffle organ fruiting body, does one truffle fruiting body only produce the one type of truffle spores, or does it produce both?
Yeah, good. Yeah, it produces both. Yeah.
Okay.
So when you look at the truffle, the white bit in the truffle is connected to the tree. So it's the mycelium. So the white bit is only one mating type, but the spores it produces are both. They'll have both male and female in those spores. Yeah.
So one truffle could create another truffle in and of itself within the spores that are within it.
Yeah, absolutely. If that truffle degraded there in the ground, you've got all that spore in the spore bank, and that could further propagate more truffles. So yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And when you're in your process of truffle cultivation, mm-hmm. do you go that deep in terms of looking at a microscope to make sure that two spores of this different types are connecting, or do you just have a pool of enough spores that you know that two are going to mix? How does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we
or about getting into too secretive of the, no. the technique? Is it, if you could talk about this, this would be really awesome.
Yeah, definitely. So when we create trees, we make sure there's a huge mix of genetic material in there. So not just male and female strains, but a whole mix of different genetic colonies in there. So they're quite diverse when they're planted. But then when they're in the ground, what tends to happen is you get one mating type slowly starts to dominate, and they can locally dominate in areas, you know, they can slowly start to take over. So then as truffle cultivators, what we want to do is make sure we can keep production going and make sure that doesn't become an issue. So it's quite popular now, actually, in some circles to add spore to your ground, you know, via different methods to add more spore in there to help to help propagate more truffles. So that's so we have some techniques around that. We have helper bacteria we add to facilitate that. And you can get some really good results. Typically takes about 16 months to see an impact. But depending where you're applying it and how you're applying it, that can be really beneficial in truffle cultivation. And in fact, in Spain, you know, like years ago, they always used to take the rotten truffles at the end of the season, ones which they couldn't sell, and they just plow them back into the soil. And subsequently, we know, you know, that was probably a very good thing to do. You know, it's good. It spreads that spore out. But insects, you know, will do that very naturally. They'll take bits of rotten truffle and spread that for you, along with a nice little pellet of nice bacteria and fertilizer and stuff like that. And they'll leave it right next to, you know, in the root zone, you know, where we've got a lot of root activity. So
yeah. Nice. I'm sure largely you deal with a lot of like bigger scale cultivators, but if you imagine, because, you know, currently I don't have our own property, and so there's no point mm-hmm. in me planting a blooming truffle tree or anything yet. But yeah. I would like to do that on a small scale. I'm sure there's others, but mm-hmm. so imagine someone's talking like in the back of their garden or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, they're thinking of like, oh, you know, I'm going to live here for a while, so I might as well have some fun, plant some truffle trees. First question is, I mean, you said you could add the necessary ingredients to the soil to overcome places which weren't mm-hmm. optimal.
Yeah.
Is that possible? And how does that look like? And yeah, so that's my first question.
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so you definitely can. So that one of the biggest soil important parameters in truffle cultivation is soil pH. So it's how alkaline your soil is. So if you're on chalk, if you've got a problem growing rhododendrons or azaleas, that's high pH soil. So that's probably quite good soil to start with. The majority of soil in the UK isn't like that. It's quite acidic. Excuse me, so you want to add lots of lime to the soil. And we're shooting for a pH level of 7.6 or above. So I've done it here. I've got a little truffle hedge here where I've planted trees super close, and I've just added lots of lime. I'm in Scotland with a very acidic soil, and I've added lots of lime to the soil and then planted my hedge. So that's, yeah, one of the key things you need to do. And then you need to do good weed control around the base of your tree so it can really thrive. And those are your key things, really.
And on your own truffle hedge plant, when you've added the lime, I guess, as the main yeah. ingredient to correct the pH, how are you testing the pH, and are you adding a little bit at a time, I'm guessing, doing it bit by bit so you don't over pH it?
yeah, absolutely. Actually, so pH is what's called it's another technical term. It's called a logarithmic scale. So it means that as we're going higher, we need proportionally a lot more lime to achieve those high levels. So it's actually very, very hard to get too high. And what I did here was I tested my soil. I worked out roughly how much lime I needed. And then I added a shed load more. So I just like totally maxed it out. And I've only done it in a small band, unfortunately, on mine so far. So I need to do that. Further out into the grass, and that's the job for this winter. I just haven't got around to it yet. So I dug it in this band and just added shed loads of lime, and so I could still see it in the ground. And so I think my pH there is probably about 8 at the moment around the trees, so it's quite high. But the mycorrhizae is thriving when I check with the microscope. And now I'm training my puppy up, so she's hopefully she'll be hunting that hedge, you know, when the season starts later this year.
Yeah. And what's the What would you recommend as the best way for someone like me to test the pH of a soil? Because I've thought about doing this, even for looking at potential truffle sites to go to. Like, I'll go there, and one of the things I should probably do is just test the pH.
Yeah.
How would you recommend?
Yeah, absolutely. So the key thing to avoid really are you find in garden centres, DIY stores, they quite often sell a pH meter, we call it. So it's like a little disc with two metal probes coming off that you're supposed to be able to push into the soil and it would tell the pH. And in our experience, the ones we've had, they give you the same figure no matter what the soil. They're really highly inaccurate. So you want to use a glass bulb probe. So you can buy these pH meters online. They're used in hydroponics quite a lot. So that's a really good source for them. And what you do is you take the soil, you mix it with the same weight of water, mix it into a slurry, and you put the probe into there, and you can calibrate these probes as well. And they're super accurate. And that's definitely by far the best thing to do. You'll see them are sold in hydroponic shops, of which we've got lots in the UK, or science retailers online. But yeah, one of these it's like a glass bulb probe, and make sure that it's one that you can calibrate. And that, yeah, you'll get those for 30 or 40 quid. So somewhere towards the cheaper end, and that should serve you pretty well.
Amazing. That's so good. I'm so going to do that. And also I just thought, you mentioned, you know, planting your truffle stuff outside, or even in the early days of planting any truffle orchard. Mm. You know, I think you said it takes 18 months approximately for you to start to see traction. Is that right?
That's when we add the spores. So that's to see a difference when we add spores and bacteria to the soil. Typically, when you plant your tree, we normally advise when people are doing an orchard is testing the roots every year so you can see if there's any issues there and monitor it. But in the UK climate, it seems to be about 6 years before you begin production, assuming it's well managed. The caveat to that is a lot of people haven't checked before year six, and a lot of people don't even check at year six, actually. But the ones that are checking, year six seems to be about right. But you do get some spontaneous early production. I was out of site, California, just a couple of weeks ago. So there's a truffle festival there, Napa Truffle Festival. Been running for 11 years, and we visited an orchard just before the festival. We were one of the dog handlers, you know, they're doing training, and we were looking at plant health, and she called us over, and we're kind of ignoring it. And these are 4-year-old English oak trees. And she dug up half a kilo of truffles just around these young trees. So it does happen on young trees as well. It's a question of hunting, really. So if you were to plant in the back garden, you'd be looking at least 6 years. And when you're doing it on a small scale, it can be longer, you know, it can be shorter, because there's a lot of variation in truffle production. When you do it on a big field, it kind of evens out. But when you're doing it on a small scale, you could be this end of the curve or you could be this end of the curve. So, yeah. And management really helps, though.
One other thing I wanted to ask you was, with regards to looking under the microscope to see, see if for truffle activity, would that be a viable approach? Or, you know, in the same way that I just mentioned, I'm going around looking for sites, testing their viability. One thing I might do is go and check the pH. But, you know, another thing I might do is go and grab a bit of soil, come home and check it. And A, do you think that would work? And B, any tips on where you would get the soil from? Like, you know, I guess just anywhere around the tree. I suppose it's so... Yeah, and yes, that's my question. How would you do it?
So you mean looking for roots, Ben? You mean looking for roots and looking for the truffle fungus on the root system?
I think so, yeah. Because Buddy at the moment, like he's hit and miss. He's early days. Yeah. And it's probably going to take, I think with any truffle dog, it's going to take years for them to really become like 100% reliable. Yeah. And especially when you're looking at new sites, it's like everything else could, the box could be ticked, but if the dog's not like, superhero just yet, then they may not, and then you might doubt yourself. But then if I can test the pH and then test the soil and physically see truffle activity, the more I say it, the more it sounds like a good idea. But would that work in practicality?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things with that. But just on the truffle dog thing as well, I think that's a really good point. You know, when you're training a dog like we're training Roo, they work great when there's a truffle there, you know, when they're going to find it within a couple of minutes. But if you go into a wild site or a new orchard, they get bored very quickly, right? If they don't find a truffle within 3 or 4 minutes, like, what am I doing? What's the point? And that's where a lot of the training and reinforcement and the additional
work comes
in.
And doing that is actually detrimental to your dog's training. It will push them back rather than beat them up. So, and if anybody out there is training their dogs, they're like me, they'll want to like skip to level 10 before they've done level 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it could be challenging. Sorry, I interrupted. But yeah, would that work then, do you think? And how would you go about that, the microscope soil testing?
Yeah, so you can check for mycorrhiza. The two things which make it quite difficult. One is, in a wild site, you need to be lucky enough that where you've taken the sample from, there's truffle mycorrhiza there, number one. Yeah. You know, they could be a meter away from that point, or they could be 30 centimeters down. Even in a truffle orchard, once you've planted a tree, after a year, you've got maybe 9 species on that tree at least. You know, you get a high diversity. So so you've got to be lucky to find the truffle mycorrhiza in a wildwood. The other thing is, and in an orchard, you can find it on most root samples, on 80% of root samples, you'll find it. But in a wildwood, it's different. The other thing is identifying it is really hard. So you'll see pictures online, you know, and we've got pictures on the website. You get these kind of inflated club-shaped structures. That's just part of the story. What we do here is we've got a whole checklist of things we look at to make sure it's the right species. And then we crush the root tip and we put the cells under a different microscope to look at the surface cell shape and size. So it's quite a technically demanding thing. I've seen like people on YouTube and stuff, and they'll use a hand lens and go, oh yeah, that's truffle mycorrhiza. But it's not really feasible like that. You know, you need to put the hours in and train and make sure what you're looking at is that. Otherwise you'll be looking at some other fungi and tricking yourself, really. So I think the best thing for you, Ben, was really pH. And focusing on that and making sure you got the right trees as well. You know, it's the right kind of woodland, because some trees obviously won't harbor truffles. So you need to make sure you got the right species there.
And on under the microscope, with the sort of more well-known truffle species, is there quite a lot of variance in what they look like under the microscope from, like, say, the Melanosporum to the Magnatum? I'm guessing there's quite a big difference, but maybe there's closer.
Okay, there's two things there. There is difference between species, and there totally is. There's differences. You know, there can be some similarities, but there's different things, like we call, for example, ramified. Like some truffle mycorrhiza will have, you'll have the truffle bit and other truffle bits budding off it, whereas some species won't do that. So there's different things you can look for. But also within the same species, you get a lot of variation when you're looking just down the dissecting microscope, depending on how mature that mycorrhiza is. You know, they can look really different. And that's where, when we trained people here, so we haven't got a lab assistant working on this at the moment. We normally do, but right at the moment we don't. The previous one's gone to university, which is great. so we need to train someone else. Typically takes us about 8 to 9 months to get someone really well trained on it. And they'll be doing that like most days, you know, just looking at mycorrhiza. So they start to get a really good eye for the variation, even within a single species. So it is quite a complex thing. The way around that is to do DNA analysis, but that's quite expensive. So you can send it off to independent labs. They can do a PCR test, typically about 50 to 80 quid, I would guess, depending on the labs. So it gets expensive quite quickly, depending on how many samples you get. But that gives you a binary answer. You know, it's a yes or no, whether the species you're interested in is there or not. And that's what we recommend people do for independent testing. If they want someone else to look at the roots and they want a clear answer, we always say use the DNA lab, because that gives you it removes the user error, you know, and then it's not going to be someone there with a hand lens pretending they know what they're doing. Like, the DNA will give you a 100% result. So, yeah.
Fantastic.
So from your point of view, it's hard.
Go on.
You know, you're gonna have to do soil pH and put the hours in, I think, is the only thing you can do. Yeah.
Keep working on Buddy. Yeah. My plan is to just become obsessed with truffle dog training and dog scent training.
Yeah,
so
cool.
It will happen.
What are you doing now, but what are the stages you're at now? So Buddy obviously finds it when you bury it and things like that. And what's the next stages you're working on?
So we've sort of paused any scent training at the moment just because new job start, new year and all that stuff. And I think I was lucky enough, you know, Melissa took me out just after the festival, because we were just too busy leading up to the festival. And that was amazing. That's where Buddy actually found his first truffles in a wild place, which was really cool. And inevitably, that was very powerful because he was shadowing her dogs. Yeah. But, you know, I was really impressed with what he did. And then I went to other woodlands afterwards, which arguably I shouldn't have done, but I was enthused by the fact that he'd done it. And thinking about what I said a second ago in terms of you put your dog into a wild woodland and they don't have success, then you know, you could actually be doing damage. However, you know, you can easily rectify that by having some truffles with you and doing training in the woodland, which is what I did. So actually it was still a result. It's just for me, I was disappointed because he didn't find more. So I think I'm going back and I'm relearning because I think there's a lot of stuff that truffle hunters do and teach, you know, the more artistic side of things and the more old school, which has probably been passed down, passed down, passed down. But then on the complete other end of the spectrum in terms of scent dog training, you've got like, you know, the scent dog training world, which is like science-based, you know, police handler dogs, scent dogs and all that. And then it's much, much formulaic and there's probably a lot more data and research behind that. So I feel like I'm now embarking on some truffle scent courses on that in that space to take all the knowledge from there. Mix all the knowledge that I'm getting from learning from other people, truffle hunters, and my own experience, and then combining it all in the middle to turn Buddy into a super truffle dog, and you know share the journey through the podcast, share the journey through YouTube as we go. That's the plan. I'm currently I'm just doing more fun games with him. So Buddy's ridiculously good. So now I've just started getting him. I'm honing the skill of like a find it and retrieve, which arguably is not what. I would like him to dig up a truffle, gently pick it up in his mouth and retrieve it to me. So perfect solution. I'm walking through the woods, Buddy's just running off left, right, and centre, and he comes up with a truffle in, and I pop it in the bag. Like I guess that would be, you know, almost the magical scenario, but I think it's possible. You know, I've seen people do that, have dogs that can retrieve, but I also know that it's very dog dependent. You know, dogs will naturally gravitate to one behavior or another, but at the same time the trainer can train craft their dog into whatever they want, really, I think within reason. But what's the instincts feeling like of Rue at the moment? Are you like, oh yeah, she's gonna be a beast at truffle, or are you a bit like unsure at the moment?
No, I think she'll be fine at it, you know, like she finds it indoors easy, and then I just started burying them outside and just straight away it was no problem for her. So I think from talking to a lot of truffle hunters and stuff, it seems to be dogs can get distracted at a certain point in the life. If they start to get more interested in mice or pheasants or something like that, can be an issue. But I hope Rue will be okay, you know, but I haven't even got to where you're at stage with Buddy now. So I think got to do some more work. The other thing with the retrieving thing, I think is interesting. The American guys we work with, the American teams, they say they try to avoid that because when the dog digs it up, they can damage the truffle. And they call it an autograph. They say the truffle's been autographed when there's like a paw mark through it. But I guess that's one of the issues with retrieval. But I don't know if that... It depends on how good Buddy is at it, I guess.
Yeah. I don't think I'm going to go down the route. I think I'm going to get him to do a lie-down indication. Which I have sort of started doing. But the beginning stages, I didn't do specific truffle scent training with Buddy until, you know, at least 4 or 5 months. All I did before, although saying that, I was still doing scent stuff. I think the main thing, and I think this is important for any dog owner, especially pet dog owners, is just to create everything that I was doing was just building it around creating the most confident dog I could possibly do. Whatever I was doing is like, well, if he's a confident dog, nothing's going to bother him. You know, dogs become reactive because they're not confident, because they're fearful, or, you know, they have anxiety over something. And then you get dog behavior problems, you know. But if you can create a confident dog, it sets you up for being able to then train them into whatever you want. But then alongside that, we were just doing, mainly to save our skin when he was going through puppy biting mode. Like, we would do lots of find it games and hiding, you know, kibble. He's got Labrador in him, so he would you know, whatever the food was, he would hunt for it.
And
hoover up the air that we were in.
That's interesting.
The other thing that I would suggest to you as well, to like be almost like one pillar to focus on. Yeah, you can do the truffle scent bit and the confident dog, but another pillar is like, because is determination and resilience. You know, as you said, you go out in the woods, they haven't found something in 3 minutes, they might give up. So you might have another dog that would wait, you know, 30 seconds before they give up. Then you'd have another dog who would never give up. Like, there's a whole spectrum, and depending on what dog you've got, you know, you don't know, but you can encourage that drive. You can encourage that drive and make it more intense. Like, and that's something I did in the beginning. Like, simple things like encouraging drive with toys, you know, having your partner hold the dog back, and then you're waving the toy in the dog's face. Whether we did it a lot with a tennis ball, because you know, a lot of scent dog training, traditional scale police dogs, you know, the reward is always a tennis ball. So I'm like, then it doesn't matter what it is, they just got to associate the highest level of you know, reward and drive for them, and happiness and fun and joy. And for Buddy it is a tennis ball, but it could be something else. And then you would just, you know, for example, you would just wave the toy or the tennis ball. And a squeaky tennis ball works well in the beginning, because obviously it works well. And then your partner or whoever, you could even tie the dog, would hold them back. So they're like itching to get away. And that itchingness, before they actually get the release, is releasing all the chemical, whatever that is. That's helping build and reinforce that drive for the ball, or drive for whatever it is. But and then as well as increasing the drive for the ball, you're also just generally, I think, increasing the drive in the dog.
That's brilliant.
And then also when you're doing the scent games as well, it's like you've also got to strike that balance, I think, between, you know, if your dog's not finding something that you've hidden, whether it's a piece of food or something else, I do think you have to balance between, okay, they've not found it, and now you're getting frustrated because they've not found it, you're trying to wait, and then, you know, the temptation is to, like, you know, go and help them and stuff like this. But I think you've got to strike that balance between not helping them and then learning that you're not going to help them. Because if they learn that you're going to help them, they're going to, like, keep looking to you. They're like, daddy's going to step in at some point. And at least for Buddy, this is how it's worked. I'm like a stone brick wall often, especially when he can't find it. If I throw a ball in long grass, sometimes he'll, he could, you know, miss the scent. So things like that, but definitely the drive one. And I was quite, and it's also becomes a very good safety tool, because I know now that Buddy is like religious about a tennis ball. It's like, if he knows it's on me, or if he knows he thinks he's getting it, it's a safety thing. I was much more confident with him being off lead anywhere, pretty much, if I had a ball on me. And that is huge. And especially if, you know, when you're out and about and there's game and deer and mice, like, that's another one. You know, is the tennis ball that you've driven, built the drive up, stronger than his natural prey drive or her natural prey drive for a squirrel that's running? It's a difficult one. And as best as you can, you want to avoid any scenario where they actually do hunt something and then have the end result, like they've grabbed it, because then they've just had the result, they've had the experience, and then you're going to have to work, you're going to have to do 100 repetitions now doing the right thing to overcome that. And every time that happens, it's crazy. So it's best to, you know, number one rule of dog training, I think, is management and control. Just don't let it, just don't let it happen in the first place. And just long lines. I'd still take Buddy out on a long line.
So how do you build that drive into the tennis ball? So are you not letting him have it all the time? Are you taking it away in between training sessions, so it's like a special thing?
100%. For what we did, and people probably do things differently, in the house, toys were not left around ever. you know, freely.
Yeah.
We would have, and obviously when a puppy, you know, you've got the biting and you have to put something in their mouth. So we would have like allowable toys, like, you know, those nylon rubber bone things, or one thing that was really good was they, those coffee tree roots that they sell in pet shops and things, which is like, it's basically like a stick, but it crumbles, it doesn't splinter. So it's a bit bit safer for them. And so letting him have those type of things in the times where he's awake, but you don't want him to chew the sofa.
Yeah.
But then toys would be coming out when, you know, it was either playtime or training time plus playtime. But with the tennis, with the tennis ball thing, I think we started with a, you know, smaller tennis ball that squeaked and just doing a lot of, I think I did it in the garden, but I also did it in our little hallway, which is, you know, narrow walls and then doors on either end. So you can be at one end and basically the dog can't get past you. So, you know, what they want to do is grab it and run forever. But what you want to try and what you want to try and do is, I guess, begin to get them to fetch, basically.
Fetch
is actually not an easy thing to do all the time. But working in a corridor does help with doing that sort of stuff. Then just squeaking the ball. And I think the other thing as well, which I adopted really easily, because I think I was just so driven to do the best out of Buddy, but you have to be the life of the party. You literally have to be a three-year-old idiot to your dog, even in public as well, you know, with your voice, with your mannerisms, and just because if you're like playing with a toy and you're just doing nothing and, you know, you're expecting them to get the enjoyment out of the toy, that's, I think, the wrong way to do it. They need to get the enjoyment out of the toy that's attached to you, because you're holding it, you're releasing it. Or that's another good thing with how's the biting stage with Rue at the moment? Is it there?
Yeah, good, actually. Good? Yeah, so she's been there, so she's been doing it.
Yeah.
And then we've, you know, she tries to chew wooden furniture, so I've just been giving her sticks and that's how, but I just stop her, you know, if she's doing it, I just say, Rude, no. And she just, that's the only time I use anything negative, is to stop her biting. Everything else is positive. And yeah, she's good with it. She will sometimes if she's hungry, and sometimes right at the end of a walk, because if we've walked her too long, she circles and she'll bark. So I've just been working on stopping that. Trying to mitigate that. But I think that toy thing is brilliant, because we have toys out all the time, you know. So, and I always, I am like a 3-year old. I play with them like that. But I think having one special toy, like you were saying, and keeping that away and just bringing it out for special occasions is a super good idea.
And then over time, I've got this from, I guess, speaking to lots of other dog people and truffle hunters or more dog scent trainers, is once that, maybe it's not a tennis ball, it might be another toy that she gets, whatever that toy is that takes her to level 10.1, you know, over the, or 101% crazy for it. That then becomes the truffle dog training toy reward.
And it
only comes out then.
Yeah.
You know, so that's what I'm moving on to with Buddy. But at the same time, I would still take a tennis ball out with me for the safety reasons and things like that.
That's super good. Yeah, I'll definitely do that. Because right now we use tiny pieces of cheese, because she doesn't eat that much. You know, she's not really food motivated, which I hadn't quite realized about this breed. But cheese she is. So I discovered cheese. She's down with cheese. So we use that as a treat. But I'm very aware as well that there'll come a stage in her life where we have to be quite careful of that, because you don't want to just feed her loads of calories, right, when you're training or when you're hunting, because that could backfire, I presume. So a toy sounds like a really good really good way to do it.
And if you get into any if she likes meat as well, one thing I did, I mean, Buddy, I'm lucky with Buddy, because, you know, pretty much will eat anything, he'll do anything for like kibble, but I had a little food project going on last year where I'd start making my own biltong.
Cool.
With relatively cheap cuts of beef, but just hanging and then drying it. And I thought, you know, compared to the price of like a beef dog treat you get in a dog pet shop, it's actually works out way less if you make a decent bulk of, like, you know, silver side beef and then you just cut it up into little cubes, and it's preserved and it lasts a long time. So that would be my recommendation. If your dog's fussy, like if it turns its nose up at steak, basically that would be funny. But
she just but I think it's the other thing is it's a bit of a control thing, isn't it? So I started now, if she doesn't eat her food within a few minutes, take it away, and that's it for a few hours, and then put it down, because she was becoming quite fussy. So I'm slowly learning. It's my first dog, you know, and this stuff is super interesting, you know, and it's super good stuff. And we've got her doing, she's pretty obedient. She's really good. She does a lot of sit, puts a paw out, she'll turn around, you know, she's got lots of tricks. But it's things like this, you know, that just didn't occur to me, and all stuff I need to learn. So, yeah, it's really, really useful stuff. Yeah.
Awesome, awesome.
I was going to say actually on the
dog. I could talk about dogs forever, so don't worry about it.
This links dogs and truffles actually. So we just had a paper published today, which is open access. Anyone could go on and access it. And it's we did a study in Cambridge Botanical Gardens, so part of a group who's doing the analysis on this. And we had a researcher go out and follow the same path every time they were out with a dog, with a trained dog, you know, and obviously a trained researcher, and look for truffles. And as part of this, this tiny bit of the analysis didn't make the end paper, actually. It's buried in the data set. But sometimes we did this on consecutive days, and where you took exactly the same path, the same dog, the same handler, similar conditions, on the second day, quite often we'd find truffles again on the second day, even though that area has been covered. So it's just got me thinking more and more about that. You know, there's so little research done on the actual truffle dog side of thing. And, you know, it's really clear that dogs, you know, they're like people, and, you know, they have good days, they have bad days. There's things which impact that scent distribution, but also when does the truffle release the scent, you know, what's happening. So we're trying to do more research on this at the moment. And I'm actually, I'll mention it to you now, Ben, just in case if you start finding with Buddy and you're interested in taking part, because we've got a few months before the season really starts. But I've got people in the US and some in Europe where they're going to go out and do the same transect. It can be as short as 100 meters. And then counting how many truffles and weighing them and grading them that they found along the way. But importantly, doing it on consecutive days. And doing that a couple of times a month and just logging the data. And we're doing it for a range of truffle species, so we can start to build up an idea, because then I can link it with weather patterns as well. So I can bring down the climate data, look at what's influencing how the dogs are finding stuff and what the drivers are. So it's super interesting. So if you start finding with Buddy and you fancy taking part, let me know. I'll send you the protocol sheet. And if there's anyone else, because the more the better, and we can anonymize it so locations won't be given, anything like that, you know, in the paper. It's just to build this data set, and so we can all learn and work out what's happening going forward. So
100%, yeah, that sounds awesome. I'll have to quit my job by then, have the time to do it.
Yeah,
but that also reminded me, and so the best moment of my life by quite a long way, and probably Danny's life as well, is Julie, who you met at the truffle from the Real Truffle Hunters. She invited Danny and I out to go white truffle hunting with them.
Yeah.
Best, like properly white truffle hunting. None of this thing done for tourists. And they don't even do this. So it was like just an invitation to live with them for like 4 days.
Wow.
Blew my mind beyond belief and was obviously my first introduction to, you know, I smelt and ate my first white truffles and other species as well. Is mind-blowing. But one of the things that really struck me as like different to what I was expecting, it was I was kind of expecting to go to some area and then we'd be out for hours, you know, just walking and just doing a route, and I think maybe that can work in the UK in certain places, but that wasn't how it was at all, because of the nature of the land and where these things are. It was like right, we'll off-road 4x4 into the bottom of this valley, and then we'll get the dogs out. 5-10 minutes. Truffles, no truffles. Okay, boom, next site.
Yeah.
Truffles, no truffles, next site. But what was interesting relating to what you were saying was over 3.5 or 4 days is what we did it.
Yeah.
The team of truffle, because there was a team there, and they got 12 truffle dogs. You know, the team of truffle hunters would be going to one site in the evening before, we would go to it in the morning and walk over the same spot, and yet we would find the truffle in the morning and they wouldn't have found it.
Absolutely.
And not even overnight, but even we would go back to the same spot from morning to afternoon and then find a truffle in the afternoon at the site. So Julie's partner and one of the other truffle guys that were there, you know, their suspects were like, you know, the truffle, and this is probably not based on, you know, someone with your background, but, you know, more of a truffle hunter's background. Their belief was that maybe it's sort of releasing its scent spontaneously within that sort of time frame. And so I think there is something there, because I experienced it. I mean, obviously there's some variables there. You've got dogs, you've got different dogs, but you know, sometimes we did it with the same dog. So it's like, well, the same dog like missed the scent in the morning and got the scent in the afternoon, or something like that. And then we found like truffles. It was crazy.
Yeah, definitely. When did you do that, Ben? What time of year was it you were there?
Last weekend of October.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So right in the thick of it. Yeah,
right in the thick of it. I mean, there apparently it's still like a really bad year for them as well. But we found some good big truffles. I think the biggest one we found was a 172 gram white truffle. Obviously we didn't get to eat that, but like, fortunately, the way that they deal with their truffles is they were only really, the ones that were marketable were ones that were like 10 grams or above. So all the small little nuggety ones, which are either imperfect or even if they're just so small, they wouldn't sell them on. So we got to eat all of those, which was really nice and just incredible. Yeah. But
and when they're super fresh like that, the aroma is completely different, isn't it? To the ones you sometimes see for sale and you know, which might be 10 days old or something, and they're super fresh, especially that white truffle. It's just like, it's a different thing. Yeah.
Well, I've not actually had the experience, I don't think, with smelling not smelly white truffles, other than I can't remember the name of it, but with one of the white truffles that we dug up was, you know, quite big, probably the size of a golf ball and a half. Yeah. But yet it didn't really have the intense aroma. And I can't remember what Julie said, whether it was like just an unripe one or maybe it was just a bit of a dud. But interestingly though, and this is not just like them doing this, but that truffle would still get sold off and mixed in with all the other very smelly mushrooms because it would pick up some of the aroma. But I'm just reading. Sorry, I'm getting sidetracked here, but I'm just reading that book, Truffle Hound, at the moment.
Oh, right, I haven't seen that. Yeah.
So it's such a good book. I think it was published in mid 2021, but obviously by someone who's very good at writing as well, and someone who ended up getting fascinated about truffles, and it's just his journey. But one thing I didn't realize is with the industry is chefs and restaurants buying them, they don't care about the aroma when they're buying them, which is just like mind-boggling. Like the truffle should be, you know, primarily sold on like its freshness and aroma, because that's arguably what you're buying. But they just want to get the right size truffle that's big and can shave nicely on top of the thing. So it's I'm just sort of exposed to that recently, but it's I'm just
I would say that's
I think that's some of the messaging that I need to get out to the world, and like, why are you buying your truffles based on size? But for restaurateurs and chefs, you can understand why, because they're in it just for the money, not maybe necessarily experience or the taste.
I would say it's quite varied, that actually, because some of the chefs we work with, certainly Ken Frank, who hosts a festival out in the States, he's like a truffle nut. And for a lot of the ones we work with, it actually, you know, they are really keen on aroma. So they, a couple of ones we supply in Scotland, actually, they don't really care about size and shape. They just want that fresh aroma, but I think it's different everywhere, isn't it? Because exactly like you say, I've had them in restaurants where you get almost no aroma and they're just using it as a dressing. You know, that truffle might have been there for 3-4 weeks in the restaurant and they're just using it for a window dressing, whereas really you want the pungency.
I must say, I've never quite had the wallet to experience white truffles in a restaurant yet, so maybe I'll learn wrongly or rightly. But the other,
I haven't had put my hand up. I've not had white truffles in a restaurant. Lots of the blacks and summers, but I don't think I've had fresh white truffle in a restaurant. Yeah,
so, yeah. Well,
same boat. Yeah.
The other thing I mean, this is just me having a rant now and a moan, but we went to a nice restaurant in Christmas time with my family, and they had on the menu, they had, because in the UK, they had autumn truffle in the description. And I thought, okay, you know, I'll order this and hope for the best. But probably won't get a massive portion, but I was at least thinking I was going to get some fresh truffle. Yeah. There. And I was probably, my judgment was clouded because a couple of weeks before, like, we had about 800 grams of truffle left over from the festival. So I was running around Brighton and other places like a maniac, speaking to chefs and like, yeah, you want to, we ended up preserving them all. But but that maybe misled me because I was thinking, oh, I'm definitely going to get some fresh truffle for this meal that came out. It was a fish dish. And I ended up taking a spoonful of the sauce, and I was like, I was almost put off to grotesquely because obviously they just used truffle oil, and I think too much truffle oil, and you know, I'm obviously been spoiled because, you know, I just spent a weekend eating white truffles all weekend, and then you know, going to a truffle festival and eating some really fresh truffles, and then so I've got the taste for it. But then I think once you do get that taste for it, and then to be hit with you know, the arguably the chemically flavor on the intense flavor, it really put me off. But then I thought, and I don't know what your thoughts are on this. I think it's mis-selling. They can't put autumn truffle. They surely need to put truffle oil or something, or, you know, something. Anyway, I'm really hesitating to rant because it really wound me up, you know, so that I was prepared to, in fact, what there's the last nail in the coffin. I was complaining around the table to my parents, making them like look at me and frown, and sort of my brother was like cringing because he didn't want to be embarrassed by me making a fuss. But and then I ate the fish, and it was actually nearly stone cold, so I ended up being a little moaning cry baby, and I sent my food back and didn't ask for anything more. So
that's fine. But, I think the truffle oil though, it is like some of the chefs we work with, you know, they rant against it, and I know the ones which are closest to me definitely don't use it, but I have been in a Michelin star restaurant, you know, a newly awarded one, and I won't say which one, and the first taster which came to the table, you know, it's a special occasion, like I think it was our anniversary or something, so we'd splashed out, and it was listed as truffle, and it came and it was truffle oil, you know, I could smell it coming to the table, and I was like, come on. And there was no truffle in it. It was truffle oil, and that's a Michelin star. I'd received a Michelin star.
Well, and it was like, I'm gonna put my flag in the ground now and say that I'm gonna try and ban this somehow. You know, it's misleading. Yeah. And they're obviously just profiting from it, but
But one thing we should say is what it actually is, really, Ben, as well, the truffle oil, because they use one compound which is similar to, well, it is the same compound, be it distilled from petroleum or however it's manufactured, as to one of the aromatics in especially white truffles. So it's just one aromatic compound, and they use it in such high quantity that it's really overpowering. But in a real truffle, you know, you can have like 300-400 different volatiles, and they're all contributing. And as you know, when you've got truffles, they've all got a slightly different smell. They've all got a character. You can line them up and they're always slightly different. And it's just a more complex thing, isn't it? Whereas truffle oil, I think, desensitizes people to what truffles actually are.
But, And this guy, I forget, Rowan Jacobson, I think, is the author of The Truffle Hound. But yeah, he's talking about this as well. And I think now there's a, I mean, I don't want to poo-poo on any truffle businesses that are selling truffle oil, but I think the next phase now is truffle oil made with real truffles. But what I've just read in Rowan's book is, in order for them to be able to say that it's made with real truffles, all they're really doing is using some, you know, little piece of not one of the more desirable, expensive truffles, or one that's even probably got even that much flavor. But then that's what they're doing now, and so it is what it is. But at the same time, it has its place, I think, truffle oil. And then there's people that actually start to like the taste of truffle oil related dishes and products and stuff, which is almost a different kettle of fish. But one thing I would say though is, you must have seen the, or heard of the UK company Truffle Guys. Truffle Guys, I'm a big fan. Like they've two guys, I think they must be London based, but anyway, they're philosophy, as I guess, is to create truffle-related products that are a bit more affordable. Yeah. But I haven't tasted all of them, but they've got this truffle dust. And okay. It's not like a fresh truffle, fresh out of the ground and stuff. But actually, when you haven't got those things, I would really recommend this truffle dust. It's it tastes good. It doesn't really taste overpowering. You can sprinkle it on like anything. So I'm a big fan of that. So kudos if they're listening. Like, that's a great product. Need to try some of your other products. Send me some. Cheers. Definitely, review them.
Cool. Is that made with a? Is it made with the additive? Is it made with that truffle aroma, as they call it? Is it just because they can do it in different concentrations? Yeah. Black truffle oil is the same chemical, just less of it. You know, so they can do it in different amounts, can't they? So maybe it's
off the top of my head. I can't remember. It's been a while since I've actually looked at the back of the label, but I mean, there's obviously something going on there. It's not like 100% truffle, but anyway, it was a good product. I felt, but
yeah, I'll look that up. Yeah, good tip.
Paul, I've got just one last question because I'm, you know, I'm conscious of your time, and it's been great so far. We've covered a lot.
Yeah.
And I know this question, you've probably been asked it quite a lot, but and I'd love to just hear your thoughts on it. With regards to growing, cultivating white truffles, the tuber magnatum, where are we at with it? And what's the challenge with it?
Yeah.
And what's the future like? Do you think we're going to crack it?
Yeah, so it's a really big question, actually. And I've been doing the rounds over the last year and a half with a... science publications, like we did an article in Nature, one in Wired, one of the online publications. We've done quite a lot on white truffles. So where we're at with it is they try to use techniques very similar to the Perigord truffle, which began production back in the 70s, and applied it to white truffles. And until very recently, that's been largely unsuccessful. And I would estimate that at least 1 million trees inoculated with white truffles have been planted across Europe. And the successes, there was a success case in Italy, which was presented at a conference. We subsequently sat there and sort of pulled it apart, and the truffles were found on the edge of where the planting was, right bordering a natural truffle-producing wood. So it looks like it was actually from these wild truffle-producing trees, so that was subsequently withdrawn. So that's not really right. And then before I get into the successes, I want to mention a bit about the ecology. So when you were out with Julie... what's quite interesting is where you find white truffles in the ground, quite often you can't find the mycorrhizae, you can't find that bit of the organism attached to the tree. Sometimes then when you find the mycorrhizae in the ground in the wild, you don't find the truffles. And this to me hints that its biology is more complex, and maybe it's only mycorrhizal, only attached to the tree for maybe only part of its life cycle. And there's other fungi which can do this. They attach to a plant for part of their life cycle. Then they can go off and be free living and live off decaying matter. And so I think its biology is more complex. Having said that, there was, you probably saw in the media, you know, a French team who claimed to have succeeded producing truffles. And I believe them, actually. So I've looked at the data, I've looked at the papers on it. It's really interesting. They've produced a small number of truffles on, I think it's one or two orchards, and it looks legitimate. One thing I would say is super exciting. One thing I would say about it is, bear in mind, there's like over 1 million trees which have been planted, and we've just got these few successes. We don't know how to replicate that, so it's not clear what they've done that is different, because what they've done is very similar to what's been tried elsewhere. So there might just be something there in the ground which has helped it to work. The other thing is they stopped monitoring the mycorrhizae. This is quite telling. They stopped monitoring the mycorrhizae, you know, on the root tips of the trees in that orchard, because they're hard to find. And they started just quantifying the DNA from the soil. So that just tells you that the organism's there. It doesn't tell you it's attached to the tree at the time. So it's... super interesting. You know, obviously we've inoculated trees in the past and we've never planted them because I've never wanted anyone to plant them because of the low success rates. But we're at the little truffle center we're setting up here. We're doing a white truffle area there where we're putting our own trees in. So have a crack at it. But I'd love to spend more time working on tuber magnatum, because I think its biology is more complex. There's more going on there, and it just makes it more interesting. So I think we're a long way off that being replicated and that being a viable activity for people, you know, but it's super exciting that we've got those results in France, and credit to the team, but it's we're a long way off, I think, having a repeatable system for that, unfortunately, but maybe in the future.
Exciting times. Yeah. And what big projects or things that you've got coming up on the horizon that you're working on and excited about?
Yeah, so Truffle Dog Study, I just mentioned, doing lots more work with insects and more complex food webs, and understanding how the truffle spore has moved across different trophic levels. So that's animals feeding on other animals which have got spore in the ground and things like this. We're doing a lot of work with DNA sequencing. So we've got this new lab we're setting up, and this little truffle centre in Scotland, which should just be really cute and be good fun. And all those kind of things, Ben. So it's a million miles an hour, you know. There's just like lots to research and not enough time. And I'm just 100%.
How far? I think I remember you saying you're on a Scottish island, aren't you? But how far up are you? And how far up are you? And is it the West Coast? And the reason I'm asking is because Danny's mum and her partner are. I think they've just put an offer down on a place like really high up on the West Coast of Scotland. So. Future holidays and trips up there, and then it'd be great to come find you as well and say hello.
Yeah, definitely. I'm hoping to have this set up this year. Our field is currently limed. We've got 40 tons of lime sat on the surface. It's been too wet to mix it in. We're just waiting for it to be dry enough to mix in. So we'll have it all set up quite soon. So you should definitely come and visit. But we're on an island called the Isle of Bute, which is the same. It's just across from Glasgow. So it's no higher than that. So once you're at Glasgow, which you'd probably do going up the West Coast, it's about another 40-minute drive west. And then you jump on a ferry, which is one every hour. You don't need to book. And the ferry's like 40 minutes. Quite often see porpoises on the ferry. And then you're on the island. So nice and accessible. But I'm probably more accessible than it sounds like the place they're buying. It sounds like that's quite quite a way north.
Yeah, it is. They've got their eyes set on the remote Scottish lifestyle, and rightly so, you know.
Exciting. So,
looking forward to those trips. But
You have to let me know where it is. That's that's exciting. Yeah. And definitely call in as you're going up.
Yeah, definitely. And so without further ado, is there any way, before we wrap up, is there any way you'd like, if people want to find out more about what you're up to, or if people are interested in, you know, truffles and trees and growing them, or where can they find more information? How can they best get in touch with you?
Yeah, sure. So the website has a contact form in. So anyone for those kind of inquiries. So it's plantationsystems.com. And you'll learn more about what we do and where we work in the world and those kind of things. And then on my informally on my Twitter, you know, whenever we have a new publication, a new article, scientific articles, I normally post them on there, and that's just at Summer Truffle. So Summer Truffle's the handle, and so I'll just post things on there, and that's all it is. It's just truffles and truffle research. So it's a good one to follow if you're into that kind of stuff.
Fantastic. Paul, it's been a pleasure. Really enjoyed speaking to you.
Yeah, been really good fun, Ben. And thanks for chatting, and happy to do it again if needed. And it's been good fun.
Yeah, would absolutely love to have you back on, and I'll definitely hold you to that. And let's stay in touch, and have a nice rest of your day.
Yeah, awesome. You too. That was good fun. Thank you very much, Ben.
Well, cheers.
That's it for this episode. If you enjoyed it, please consider subscribing or leaving the podcast a review. Please also share this podcast with a friend or loved one who you think will enjoy it too. Also, in 2022, I co-hosted the first ever UK Truffle Festival and Truffle Dog Championships, where we celebrated the British truffle. At this mini festival, there was truffles, mushrooms, wild talks, interesting and quirky local businesses, gorgeous truffle-inspired food, English sparkling wine, and of course, lots of dogs. And we'll be running it again each and every year. This event sold out in its first year, and it's likely that will happen again next year too. To ensure you don't miss out for 2023, be sure to join our email waitlist. To join the UK Truffle Festival waiting list and to be notified when tickets go on sale, go to trufflefestival.co.uk and sign up. Talk soon and keep truffling.